Well, I don't want to press the point further. Generalized, it means this, that rightly or wrongly, and I think rightly, those of us professionally in education believe that education at all levels, from the kindergarten or first grade up, under proper supervision and control and without waste, we believe that all such education is a good investment. We think we get our money back for the people of the state or the people of the community. Recently, as you know, a national magazine wrote up the University of Illinois entirely in terms of its research contributions, mentioning what it meant to have better corn and better cattle and better roads and better railroads and better airplanes and better radio and television, and better use of all these things on the part of the university, meaning the University of Illinois, merely as an illustration of what would be the value of research. This author, whom I didn't know personally until he came here, who had no contact with the university previously, decided that the University of Illinois was such a tremendous asset that this state would be most noticeably impoverished, or would have been over the years, had not these researches gone forward and had not the knowledge gained by them been sent out through students and through our extension work. Finally, in this general area, let's remember that in our present circumstances, our whole security, our survival, seems to depend upon our researches and on our understanding. I'm not a political scientist, and I'm not a military expert. I have only the advantage of listening to these people once in a while, especially when they agree and come forward with some resolution or statement. And one of the things that all the historians and political scientists and military leaders of our time seem to agree upon is this, that we are in an immediate and terrible danger. And we're not just in danger of a gradual ideological infiltration, treacherous as that may be. We're in danger of a two-pronged assault, one from ideas, which we seem to be able to beat back pretty well, so far as our country is concerned, and second, from straight military invasion, which leaves us with many doubts and worries. And the one thing, now not according to the political experts, but according to the military experts, and you read them just as much as I do, the one thing that saves us, that gives us time to get ready on a broad basis instead of on a single front, is the atomic bomb. And the atomic bomb, as we know, is nothing but a technological applied byproduct of fundamental researches that have been going on for the last 30 or 40 years, starting with a few mathematical formulas, a few highly abstract, you might say simplified statements, never tried out in an experimental or engineering or chemical way, but just put down as ideas. Then from that stage, pushed into the next experimental stage, still not practical, still not technological, still theoretical, but now involving chemical reactions and machinery, studies of metallurgy to see what metals could resist the kinds of actions being played upon them while various things were being made. Now, at that stage, there was produced, as you know, this uranium fission. Even then, in those earlier days, a question of curiosity as to whether it could be done and what it would mean to science. And all the earlier scientists that I have talked to about it, in the days before it was classified as secret, emphasized the positive, therapeutic, bacteriological, biological values that might come from such work, such as the replacement of the need for x-rays and so on. And much of that is already coming to be realized. The engineers, in turn, talked, and we now know with great sense, about this great power in the nucleus, which, if properly released and controlled, would drive our engines, drive our great ships, supply power to countries that had never had coal or oil, and in the most transportable and acceptable fashion. Well, we know that all this has had an immediate and terrific military application, such that it has the effect. This one discovery, which came almost entirely out of universities, out of long and short-haired professors, and we can name them in this country and abroad, such that this one discovery carried to this one practical end in a bomb is the equal of hundreds of divisions. If there is anything else that keeps the hundreds of divisions of Russia from marching into the Near East, Europe, Africa, India, and Southeast Asia, then the military experts do not know what it is. They don't think it's any religious restriction. They don't think it's a moral restriction. They don't think it has anything to do with ethical procedures. They think it's a straight case of their great military powers being offset, and probably more than offset at the present time, by this one great academic, theoretical, university-type discovery. Well, now that is certainly the most dramatic of all, but now let's turn to agriculture. When you ask, why is it that a great country, at least a potentially great country such as Russia, could be taken over by such a totalitarian state and devoted to such aggressive and cruel and diabolical ends, then you get into studies that are no longer studies of physics or mathematics or chemistry. Now they become studies of agriculture, of biology, of populations, of politics, of science. Hungry people don't necessarily start wars. China, hungry most of its national life, never started any wars except with a few firecrackers until the time the communists took them over. And their firecrackers were used primarily to scare themselves. And as we know, gradually China, perhaps rapidly, China was taken over. Why? I don't remember reading of any hundreds of divisions of Russians marching into China. I don't remember reading that any atomic bombs were exploded there to scare them. They were taken over, as we see it now, and as some people saw it then, pretty largely in terms of the kind of promises which have become so familiar to us that we hardly regard them as interesting. We couldn't get anywhere in this country now going around, say, in a radical movement, promising a person that he would get food. And if all the food he was going to get was a few handfuls of rice a day and a dried fish, I don't think we'd stir up anything at all. We're way beyond that. But there was a time in this country when this drive for food was so strong and so permanent that you couldn't get people interested in anything else. You couldn't get our New England pioneers to talk about liberty in the earlier days, long before the Revolution, when they had to live. They wanted liberty, and they fought for it. But they didn't fight for it until they somehow found a way to survive at all. Therefore, any group, such as the communists, who will promise food and deliver some of it, has a tremendous psychological advantage. It doesn't have to make the deliveries at the time. About all it has to do is to make the promises for a while. As I see it then, in agriculture, in our tremendous knowledge, our tremendous know-how, to use the slang expression, of production and distribution and preserving and freezing and drying and shipping, of how to get over, let's say, from the plant seed through all the lines until we finally get meat on the table, all this tremendous knowledge with all its intricacies, not only in the biological sciences, but in the engineering sciences and in the economic sciences. As we develop that, we develop this great strength which we don't think at this time our enemy has. But often we are rather wasteful about it. I've been active in UNESCO, and one of the projects of UNESCO is a combined project with FAO. And that project is called Food and People, and I expect some of you have heard about it. And in that project, we're trying to get the peoples of the world, especially our potential friends, to do a better job at this individual level, to stop moving away from these hungry crowds, say in the Indian village, to start moving back to where they are, less haranguing and more planting, more demonstration of what various kinds of wheat can be made to do in India. That's going on right now under the Indian government, under experts that are imported, and particularly under the FAO. And as an interim measure, some of us believe, and I think also with respect to India, that we should ship them wheat and our surplus products. We say, well, perhaps we should ship it if they will guarantee to be friendly and not keep making eyes at communist China or communist Russia, wondering which way they're going to jump. Well, I think we need a great deal of patience, a great deal of magnanimity. Maybe by exporting food on an emergency basis, as we do to flood victims or to plague victims, and they have both, and not worrying too much about their ideas at the time, maybe that very act by itself will be helpful in swinging the balance to our side. At least that's the hope. At the same time that we do that, most of us feel we should also expect a greater and greater responsibility on their side, on the side of all the peoples who are still using primitive agriculture. As I see it, that means shipping much more than tons of wheat or tons of flour. It means shipping, let's say, hybrid corn, where we think it will grow. And along with the hybrid corn, the kind of booklets that will help farmers, and the kinds of slides and radio programs, and the persons educated in those countries, if possible, who will demonstrate those slides, who will take them to schools, who will help to build up their technical institutes. The same can be said for machinery. Not only a biological knowledge, but a knowledge of machinery. We must get many people, our potential friends, away from their terribly primitive conditions of production and distribution of food products. And then finally, in that particular chain, they must learn more about themselves. When they don't get enough to eat, and when the families are terribly large, completely uncontrolled, allowed to run around without education or health protection or adequate nutrition, inevitably the individual child becomes a little less valuable. Life becomes cheap, as we say. And while you can count them by the millions and say so many hundreds of millions of Asiatics are on our side, unless they're on our side as self-reliant people, knowing science and agriculture and economics and industry, then they won't really be allies. So what we have now, as I see it, is much more than just the individual question of how am I doing at home. It's just as it was in our own two world wars. Food, among other things, will win the war. I remember we shortened it to food will win the war. And that's all right as an expression, because everybody knows it will be qualified by some other things. And it's right in the sense that without food, the war will certainly be lost. Not only the war of military events, but this other war that I have spoken of, this war of ideas. One trouble with us, you see, is that we're honest. If we say we will deliver a shipload of wheat, we break our backs to deliver that shipload. We sustain a tremendous amount of criticism if anything happens to us, but the Russians, the communists, don't care. They can promise the Chinese or the Koreans anything and deny 6 months later that they ever said it, and 6 months after that, hang anybody who says they said it. And with that kind of control, you're rather free. It's like signing notes without any money in the bank. Well, now, let's come back to this home front. I wandered a long way from it, and yet I said myself that if we get too far from it, we will not have done a good job. And I hope, fairly explicit about this. I should hate to go to the Near East in the next X years and discover better machinery there than I might discover on our farms, let us say in southern Illinois. I think that would be wrong. But I have gone to some countries and discovered better school buildings than we find in many of our Illinois counties. I have discovered better roads, even though the people were poor. I have discovered better cities in some cases, in terms of a complete development of the city with fine public buildings and recreation and open spaces and all that. We still have a long distance to go in bringing our own local communities, whether it's a single farm or a small village or a small city or a great metropolis, up to the levels of our own standards, up to the best that we know and understand.